Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Scott Gregory, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. On our program, the poet and writer Koresh Ali Lansana. He was born and raised in Enid, Oklahoma, as Ron Miles. He originally worked in broadcast journalism here in our state before going on to study poetry in New York and Chicago. He's the author of several books of poems, and he's edited several anthologies of poetry. He's written books for children and co-authored a work of nonfiction entitled Our Difficult Sunlight, A Guide to Poetry, Literacy, and Social Justice in Classroom and Community. Koresh Ali Lansana is an associate professor of English and creative writing at Chicago State University, where he served as the director of the Gwendolyn Brooks Center for Black Literature and Creative Writing from 2002 until 2011. He'll be doing a reading and signing regarding his newest book, a chapbook entitled Reluctant Minivan, this Saturday night here in Tulsa. That would be May 3rd at 8 p.m. at the Living Arts Gallery downtown. And in fact, he'll be the first ever Living Arts poet in residence, doing a couple of workshops at Living Arts on May 5th and May 8th. More on all that in just a moment as we hear from Koresh Ali Lansana here on Studio Tulsa. Koresh Ali Lansana, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Great to have you with us.
It's good to be with you, Scott.
Congratulations on the new chapbook. It's fantastic.
Thank you.
Yeah. I was hoping you could start by reading a poem. I think this is the poem that the title of the book comes from. It's called Space.
Yeah, that's correct. It is a classic tale of daddy woe. All right, Space. Couch again, elbowed into a foot. Four-year-old grins in sleep. I cannot. Brown knit fibers itch crusty knees. MSNBC sees me late and early. Teen sons jabber fast as legs. The sun an energy drink. Juice, vitamins, coffee, breakfast for two youngest. Bananas, grapes, waffles, cereal. Socks, shoes, coats, homework, clock. Beware the reluctant minivan, cage madness at 70 miles per hour, blindside swerve, apologize by hand, lane too small for all of us.
It's a great poem. That's from the new book, Reluctant Minivan. Wonderful title for a book, I should say.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's hard to say that poems are about this or that, but I think this book is about being a parent.
Right, and very specifically about being a father.
Absolutely, yeah. And before we get into that, you're a poet where most of the time the I who's speaking the poem is you. In other words, you're writing poems about yourself, or no?
Well, certainly in this book, these poems are largely about my own experiences being a father or being a son. Or being a mentee or protege. So in this book, the I is largely me. In Mystic Turf, my most recent full length, those poems are largely autobiographical regarding my growing up in Enid and the social, cultural, political dynamics of growing up in Enid in the 60s and 70s and 80s. So yes, in that book, the I is mostly me. These two books are very different types of books from the other six books of poetry that I've published, in that they are very autobiographical. The I, or the speaker, is generally me in these two books. My previous books, the I sort of submerged.
Right.
Being trained as a journalist, you know, I published work for 10 years before I used the pronoun I in a single poem. That's how much I believe, again, trained as a journalist, that it's about the story. You know, it's about the narrative first, and it's much less about the speaker. So there's certainly the difference in these two books, Mystic Turf and Reluctant Minivan, is that these books are largely autobiographical.
Yeah, and getting back to the poem, you say early on, a four-year-old grins in sleep, I cannot. That I cannot, that's you as a parent being able, rather not being able to sleep. And
right.
I love the image that poem ends with, the minivan full of kids racing down the lane, and that lane isn't big enough to contain all of you. It's just that sort
right.
of bursting at the seams feeling of being a parent.
Uh-huh.
Did you
That's so well put.
Well, yeah, thanks. Did you want to write a book about being a parent I mean, you have four sons, right? I mean, is this?
I have four sons.
Is this a, is this a book you've been meaning to get to? I mean, when you have four sons, you've been a parent a while.
That's correct. My oldest is 16.
Okay, and I gather from reading the book that a couple are older and a couple are younger.
That's right. I have a 16-year-old, a 14-year-old, a 9-year-old, and a 7-year-old.
And we'll just go ahead and spell it out. The book is actually dedicated to four individuals. Again, I'm assuming those are your four sons.
They are my sons, Excellent. Niall, Onam, Ari, and Brooks. Right?
Okay. So in terms of, you know, your career thus far as a poet, had you been wanting to get to the fatherhood book?
Well, I've been writing these poems off and on throughout, certainly since my oldest was born. To a certain extent, for example, the second section in the book are poems devoted to my son, Ari, who is has been diagnosed as moderate on the autism spectrum. And so those poems were very focused. I'm going to write these poems about being a parent of an autistic child. So that was very sort of decided and focused. I'm going to write these poems about autism and about my son and about being a parent of an autistic child. The rest of the poems were sort of evolved over the course of, you know, the oldest being, oh, I don't know, maybe 12 years old, and certainly the most recent being just a few months ago. So being a parent and a poet, they always provide prompts and inspiration and ideas and sometimes consternation, and they are always a muse, if you will. My sons are a constant and consistent muse. And because I love them dearly and try to pay attention as a father and certainly as a poet, these poems just sort of evolved, you know. So I can't say that I decided I'm going to write a book of poems about for my sons. It was more of I write poems about my sons than I have for the last several, you know, more than a decade. And I thought, I wonder if I had a manuscript here. So then I pieced them together. And then I decided, because of my fascination, of course, with autism and with trying to be a good parent and educator for my son, Ari, those poems were very decidedly focused about that experience.
You mentioned that section two of the book is focused on Ari. I wonder if you could read the first poem in that section. I always love it when a poem that I read sends me to the dictionary. And this poem's called Echolalia 1. There's another poem right after it called Echolalia 2. Talk for a second about that term, echolalia, and then read the poem, please.
Sure. It is it's an amazing word, isn't it? and it is. It is. It's an amazing word. And it's exactly what you think the word would mean.
And it just sounds great.
It does. It's a condition of repeated speech, or what is called scripting, in the sense that my son and many folks on the autism spectrum will repeat things that they hear, things that others say, things from characters on television programs, and they will use that language because they are unable or it is difficult to find the correct and appropriate language for that particular moment. So instead of, and this was, Ari's probably about 40% now in terms of the scripting on the echolalia, but when first diagnosed, it was more like 70% of his speech. So you might ask Ari how you feel today, or how are you doing today, or how was school, and he might quote Dora the Explorer, or Diego, or the Backyardigans, or a cartoon show that he watches. And it was, like I said, he's much improved now. But that is essentially echolalia. It's scripting a repeating other's speech. It's a lot of work to move, certainly from my experience, to move Ari out of this moment of scripting speech from a TV show or what have you, and to really answering the question, how was school today? Sometimes it can be real challenging.
Yeah, and that poem so nicely sort of channels that phenomenon of echolalia. Let's hear it. This is Echolalia 1.
Right. Language echoing itself. Itself echoing language. Echoing language itself. Language itself echoing. What I heard them say. Say what? Them I heard. Heard them. What I say. I say what them heard. I mean these words I mean these I words mean these I. Why don't you hear me? Me, you don't hear. Why? Hear me. Why don't you? You don't? Why? Hear me. You make me angry. Angry you make me. Make me angry. You. You angry. Make me. In my head, I'm not alone. Alone, I'm not in my head. Head, I'm not in my alone. I'm in my head, not alone.
Some wonderful wordplay going on there. And I mean that in the best sense of the term. You've got these, really within each stanza of the poem, you've got these finite vocabularies that you can work with. It's like each stanza takes a certain number of words and just rearranges them to great effect.
Thank you. Thank you.
That's a poem from the chapbook Reluctant Minivan. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Our guest today, the author of that book, Koresh Ali Lantana, who will be here in Tulsa reading from that book Saturday the 3rd at 8 p.m. He'll be a poet in residence at Living Arts, and he'll be doing a couple of workshops on May 5th and 8th. More on that in a moment. But about the new book, let's take the title Reluctant Minivan. I laugh because it's sort of a cleverer title, but I think there's a point to that expression. I mean, the reluctance. Talk about that image, the reluctant minivan.
Well, my memory of this is in the 90s. There was a whole movement in the mid to late 90s, right after I became a father and purchased the minivan. There was sort of this movement in television commercials then and mainstream media that to own a minivan was not macho, was not a real men don't drive minivans,
right.
And it was sort of really at the height of the marketing behind SUVs. That's really when the SUV craze really sort of hit. And that was, I think, a part of the marketing strategy was to say, you know, you can be a daddy, but you don't have to own a minivan. You know, like somehow a minivan emasculates males
right.
in some way. And so that always stuck with me. And so actually, probably sometime in the 90s, in the late 90s, in response to all of that minivan angst, I wrote a poem, the draft of which became really the idea for this book. But again, that was probably, 10 or more years ago. And so I think now that you ask me that question, I think the idea of the minivan and sort of this real men don't drive minivans idea was born in that late 90s sort of anti-minivan craze. And that's where the idea sort of stuck with me. I wrote a bad poem about it, a very poor poem that I'm sure I cannot find now. It's probably not worth looking for. But it gave me sort of the idea for this title now, 10, 15 years removed.
Yeah. I definitely remember those commercials you're describing on television. And, of course, that whole ad campaign was really triggered by the fact that around that time, minivans had basically replaced station wagons as the de facto family vehicle.
That's right. I remember one friend, a poet who will remain nameless, said to me at one point, probably in the late 90s or early 2000s, like, man, you just lost all your cool, you know?
Yeah.
You just lost all your cool. You're just showing your age with driving that minivan around. Like, okay, I'm a dad.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah, it's okay. It's all right. There are a lot of us out there.
Right.
Listen, on the subject of being a dad, I'm hoping you can read from section one of the book, the poem Logic.
Sure. So Logic is actually based on a conversation with, I believe, Onam, when we were living in Brooklyn, when I was in graduate school. So here's the poem. Daddy, can we go to the store today? I want a remote control car. No, son, we cannot go to the store today because I want a rocket ship to the moon. But I can't have a rocket ship to the moon because I have to buy food for you to eat, and the electric bill is hungry too. Plus, rent is due. Even after taking care of those needs, if I could afford a rocket ship, when would we go? I have to work on Monday, and you have school. Okay, Dad, can we go to the playground, please?
I love how the title of that is Logic, because there is a certain there's a certain parental logic at work there. Like, you don't just want to be the parent who says, because I said so.
Right.
So you start trying to sort of engage them at their level. Like, here's why we can't do that. And here's why.
Right.
Wonderful poem. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. I'm Scott Gregory, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Our guest today is Koresh Alilantana, whose new book is a chapbook just out called Reluctant Minivan. He'll be reading from that book Saturday night, May 3rd, at the Living Arts Gallery downtown. And a few days later, he'll be doing a couple of workshops. Let's talk about those briefly. You'll be leading a workshop for teens and then another one for adults. Now, the one
That's
for
correct.
Teens is on Monday, May 5th. Talk about what you'll be doing there.
That one is the Verse Journalism Workshop, if memory serves me correctly. And verse journalism is a concept that was created by my mentor and teacher, the amazing Miss Gwendolyn Brooks, who was the first African-American to earn the Pulitzer Prize for poetry in the 50s. And Miss Brooks, she didn't really create any sort of rationale or explanation for her idea of verse journalism. In the first part of her autobiography, which is Report from Part One, she simply explained this concept as poet, as all-seeing eye, poet as fly on the wall. Right. And so she wrote a couple of what I would say the ultimate examples of writing in this form. She considered the archetypal poem in verse journalism a poem called The Chicago Defender Sends a Man to Little Rock, which was, of course, for the integration of Central High School,
right,
in Little Rock, Arkansas. And so I devised a lesson plan and a rationale for verse journalism. But I consider, although, you know, I can't argue with Miss Brooks, of course, and of course now she's deceased, unfortunately, but I believe that her poem, A Bronzeville Mother Loiters in Mississippi, Meanwhile a Mississippi Mother Burns Bacon, which is her long poem about the trial surrounding Emmett Till's murder, I think that's her greatest example of the form.
Okay.
But who am I to argue with Miss Brooks? But the idea, right, of verse journalism is to investigate a news event, a recent or past news event, and conduct some research and understand your opinion, understand your whole sort of take on the news idea, and then write as if you are a part of that news item, right? As if you were not reportage, but writing like from the inside out. So, for example, in the Bronzeville Mother poem, she's writing as if she is inside of the kitchen of the Bryant family, Roy Bryant, and it was, of course, his wife who set the whole thing in motion that ended in Emmett Till's murder. And so she writes as if she's inside of the kitchen while the trial is happening. And so it's amazing. She didn't go to Mississippi for the trial. She engaged all of this from research, from newspapers, from radio, and then using her vivid imagination, imagine what it might have been like to be inside of that house, to be Mrs. Bryant, to be some of the children in that house, and sort of be a fly on the wall during the trial.
That's interesting because, as you say, it's not reporting, but, well, I think of the old, who was it, Ezra Pound, poetry is news that stays news.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's almost like creating a moment, constructing a moment that's inspired by the news, but it's really, it's its own poetic moment. It's not a news
right.
report.
It's not a news report.
That's really
right.
interesting. So you'll be doing a workshop with teenagers on that at Living Arts Gallery Monday, May 5th. And then on Thursday, May 8th, you have a workshop for adult writers of poems.
Right. And that's called Stretching Exercises, which is a poetry intensive. And we will be looking at existing work of the folks who participate. And I will be sharing revision exercises as well as generating new ideas based on a series of prompts that I've created.
Getting back to the book, Reluctant Minivan, I'm wondering, though, if you could read Mr. Brown Jr. Goes to Heaven.
Sure.
This is a poem that references a jazz singer and playwright, activist, who some listeners will remember, some won't. You could maybe say a little about him and then maybe about the time in your life that this poem harkens back to.
Absolutely. I've had the great privilege of, since moving to Chicago in 88, I've had the great privilege of being mentored by a number of astounding writers and artists of all ethnicities, but most especially African American, many giants in African American arts and culture, and one of them was Mr. Oscar Brown Jr. We met because I was in a band. My second and most successful poetry band involved Oscar Bobo Brown, or Oscar Bo Brown III, so Oscar Brown Jr.'s son, who was an amazing bass player, vocalist, percussionist. I mean, Bobo played everything. And the band was called the Funky Wordsmiths, and I referenced them here in the poem. But because Bobo and I were in this band, I was taken into the Brown family. And so that meant being mentored and befriended and guided by Oscar Brown Jr., who was to really the 50s and 60s what, say, Gil Scott-Heron was to the 70s,
right.
What Public Enemy was to the 80s and 90s in terms of this powerful combination of political activism, of political consciousness, of humor, satire, of commentary with a beat.
Yeah, he was a very street smart sort of poet.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, very influential to what I do. I think, again, there would be, I don't know that rap or hip hop would exist without Gil Scott-Heron, without Oscar Brown Jr., and so many others. And so it was a wonderful decade or so that I was mentored and guided by Mr. Oscar Brown Jr., and I hope that you play some of his work at some point.
Yeah.
Folks should know who he is.
You're way ahead of me. We've got it queued up right here.
Good. All right. So, the poem. Mr. Oscar Brown Jr. goes to heaven for Oscar Brown Jr. and Oscar Bo Brown III. And I should reference that I write much of this poem in an imitation or an homage of the style in which Oscar Brown Jr. Wrote much of his own work. 1. A jump and the Buick spits a flimmy tune. A pink-skirted sister asks, who got shot? Young buck by the car is quick and numb. Sirens wail, black mama on my block. Evans Ave begs and pleads for quiet. Midnight sky grips a heavy truth. Black people gather like some kind of riot should be, but it's just spilled blood of youth. Crack house two doors down is 24/7. Door knocking, wolf calling all night long. I kneel, pour libation to Oscar in heaven, and wonder how would he tender this song. From my front stoop, not my window, miles I see, road maps carved on stone black faces, the hard lust Jones of living almost free, our hearts, our souls, and other empty spaces. The air is dense with murder, lies, and hate. Blacks lacking love kill what looks like them. It's now Memorial Day, the sun is late. Still, the Buick coughs up more phlegm. 2. I remember your first great bear hug. Yes, you all are doing it, you said, after our set at some Chicago club. Bo thumping bass till his digits bled. Nate on tenor sax and Dr. Watts. Keith and me with syllable and sound. Lovely Mama Jean, lovely the spot. The Funky Wordsmiths were in the house. Hard-hitting black poetry and song, our mantra, our call to page and stage. Your smile told us, yes, we did belong. We'll tell stories of black love and rage. 3. Minister Farrakhan, at your service, said he did not know you, but he knew the rappers brought to the precipice. Through stubborn earth, you broke new. Then the minister put out a call for rap MCs to bring your words to life. Afro blue instead of kill them all, signifying monkeys afterlife.
Some wonderful rhymes in that poem.
Thank you. I haven't rhymed in years before I wrote, in years before I wrote this poem. And that's a gift I used to have that I haven't had in many, many a moon. I'm working outside of my own comfort zone, which is always good because that's how we grow, right?
Yeah, that's what, yeah.
In that workshop, in the second workshop that I'm teaching stretching exercises, that's the whole premise, is that we work outside. You know, athletes stretch, dancers stretch, poets should stretch, right? We should give ourselves hurdles or obstacles to overcome and then do the work of doing so. And in the process, we grow.
We'll end on that good thought, Koresh. Ali Lansana, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Scott. I look forward to coming back to Tulsa Town.
Poet Koresh Ali Lansana is the author most recently of Reluctant Minivan. Koresh will be doing a reading and signing regarding this book Saturday night at the Living Arts Gallery downtown. That would be May 3rd at 8 p.m. More information at livingarts.org. You're listening to Studio Tulsa.
Said the signifying monkey to the lion one day, hey, there's a great big elephant down the way, going round talking, I'm sorry to say, about your mama in a scandalous way. Yes, he's talking about your mama and your grandma too, and he don't show so much respect for you. Now, you weren't here, and I sure am glad, cause what he said about your mama made me mad.
Signifying monkey, stay up in your tree. You are always lying and signifying, but you better not monkey with me. The lion said, yeah.
I'm Scott Gregory, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Here are the comments of Colin Hines.
The birds are singing, roses are budding, lawnmowers are roaring. You know what that means. It's not only springtime. It's standardized testing season for our public school students. Oklahoma has one of the most underfunded public school systems in the United States. Advanced placement, music, and foreign language classes have been slashed. Class sizes are growing. Teachers are woefully underpaid. Even so, our state manages to find somewhere in the neighborhood of $13 million a year to pay corporate test vendors. Out of a 180-day school year, 80 days are devoted to preparing for and taking standardized tests. For those 80 days, teachers aren't teachers. They are test technicians. There's a whole variety of tests. For example, OCCTs, Scholastic Reading Inventory, Metropolitan Achievement Test, and Acuity Benchmark Assessment. There are high-stakes tests like the End of Instruction Test, which high school students must pass in order to graduate, regardless of their letter grades. Third graders are nervous these days. They have to take reading tests or get held back. Then there are field tests. Those are the ones that serve no purpose except to help the testing companies try out new questions for future tests. They amount to free market research for the test vendors. Most kids know field tests are absolutely meaningless and just guess their way through them without reading the questions and passages. Who could blame them? I remember a time and place when the only standardized test administered was the SRA. It seems like we'd only assemble once every 2 years to carefully fill in that test ovals. Schools weren't punished for the results. A good score would catch the teacher's eye and maybe even make them think, hey, that spaz just might be college material. We were generally concerned with our letter grades and nothing else. It's obvious to anyone who has a brain to think with that all this testing is degenerate. It robs students of time during which they could be learning. It robs teachers of obtaining meaning from their profession. It robs states, like this one, of scarce funds. It seems the sole beneficiaries of all these tests are the corporate test vendors. They're the ones getting rich on taxpayer money. Parents are growing increasingly angry, and many are finding ways to opt their children out of this testing. It's about time.
Colin Hines is a local writer and attorney and regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. He's the co-creator of the blog Carpe Absurdum. That's Studio Tulsa for today. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Scott Gregory, sitting in for Rich Fisher. We'll see you next time.